First, I think it's important to talk about things over the last week and to try to define the confusion that's out there. And because things come in fragments, but what you had basically was yesterday, you had basically a week almost where things were quiet. And that led to a lot of press speculation in Israel that Israel had agreed to a ceasefire with Hamas, which the government denied. And so before I say what are the policy options, I think it's important to understand what happened over the last week, just for the clarity in our own minds. It seems to me that what happened was something that each side can deny, that Condoleezza Rice was in Egypt. The day after, then she goes to Egypt, to Israel. The day after she leaves Israel, Mark Regev, the spokesman of the prime minister, says basically, if Hamas doesn't fire on us, we don't fire on them. Now, the Israeli cabinet said, well, no, Israel's going to go after them, you know, everywhere it can. But I think what really was going on in the last week was that you had a de facto situation, that while Secretary Rice was in Egypt, she reached certain understandings that maybe the Egyptians had reached, that that Hamas won't fire on Israel, Israel won't fire on Hamas, Israel doesn't have to say they have a ceasefire with Hamas, Hamas doesn't have to say they have a ceasefire with Israel. We'll just call it a de facto situation to cool things off. And of course the question is, how sustainable is that? Well, we saw the answer to that when Israel went after these four people in Bethlehem on a Wednesday night. Two of them, Israel says, were terrorists with a long record. And then, whether it's Islamic Jihad yesterday or whoever, they fired on Israel a couple of rounds. I think there was three rockets this morning. So to me, it gets at the heart of this whole issue that for a week we had this de facto situation that no one would admit to. But that's really what the situation was. So I guess my question I want to ask is, how sustainable is that? What are the policy options, certainly for Israel, in terms of a ceasefire, not a ceasefire, or a military option, or the status quo? And what can the United States do about this situation? And what I basically want to do is to look at kind of the challenges to each policy option. Maybe some of you will be disappointed that I don't come emphatically down on one side, but I think for an audience like this, which is very sophisticated, it's actually more a useful exercise to lay out what are the challenges to each option. So let's start with the ceasefire concept. What are the challenges to the idea of a ceasefire? And I'll list, let's say, seven quickly, seven challenges. First challenge, enforcement. Who's going to enforce this exactly? Who's going to determine what a violation is? Does Egypt, which has been trying for almost 2 years, some would say valiantly, to get Gilad Shalit, one soldier, and has tried different tahadiyas in the past, different hudna, ceasefires. Why will this time be different? What leverage do they have on Hamas? Some say, well, they could close Rafah, not close Rafah. Well, then, you know, Hamas just blew up the fence there. But there's an enforcement question. Second, the question is a definitional question. What are the obligations on both sides? What we saw from the Tahadiyya and the Hudna, the 2003 and 2005 situations, is where things are not defined, it all falls apart. It only takes one incident. Each one will have a different version of who started what, but it all comes apart. So I would argue if it's not defined exactly what it is and what are the obligations on all, it won't work. And a related issue of definition is a question of, imposing it. Wraith mentioned the differences within Hamas, but there is a question of imposing discipline on the Islamic Jihad. So can each side define what their obligations are, and can they impose those obligations on their own side? Third question, there's a lack of agreement over geography. If you look at the Hamas statements coming out, and including an interesting one, one out of Damascus from the Hamas one, they say it includes the West Bank. Israel says no, and you saw Barak's answer to that, basically, when they went after those guys in Bethlehem. Fourth question, which I think for Israel might be the biggest question, is what are the prospects of rearmament? In other words, if they agree to a ceasefire, to what extent does this enable the other side to rearm? In which case, you buy time. And someone said, well, each side buys time, and maybe Israel can utilize the time better. I would argue on this point, see to my point down the road about the role of Israeli-Egyptian relations, because I think that's crucial if this is going to be the policy on working closer together. And if that isn't going to be there, really, then this certainly isn't going to happen. But that gets to the whole tunnel issue and the rockets coming from southern Gaza. Fifth question, and this might be more of a smaller tactical point, but given the enmity of the summer, where people were thrown out of windows, as Wraith said, will suddenly Hamas agree to let 1,000 members of the Presidential Guard suddenly set up shop on the crossing points? How is that PA-Hamas relationship going to work? Point six, what is going to be the role of outside actors like Iran that for their own reasons might want to heat things up? For example, right now you have a situation that at the end of the month there's supposed to be an Arab summit in Damascus, okay? Right now the Saudis have not said they're coming at the top level, I'm talking about. And my own guess is that part of Cheney's trip to the region right now is trying to buck up the Saudis, make sure they don't go to Damascus. But and the issue of the price of oil, et cetera. But I think that's part of it. But so for whatever reason, the Syrians might say, look, it's in our interest to heat things up now because we want the summit to be a Palestine summit. Because if it's a Palestine summit, all the Arabs come. If it's not a Palestine summit, people talk about Lebanon, not Lebanon. This one won't come, that one won't come. So what is going to be the role of outside actors in such a ceasefire? And point seven, what is the political utilization of Hamas in this? I keep thinking about, Dennis knows this better than anybody, but about Hezbollah of 93 and 96, Operation Accountability, Operation Grapes of Wrath. And basically, where Israel put forward Operation Accountability as a success in 93, basically Hezbollah said, we set the rules of the game. The rules of the game, which were then verbal, in 96 they were then written down, is if Israel hits a civilian, you know, we get a free kick, so to speak, at Israeli civilians. So everyone talks about how Hamas wants to emulate Hezbollah militarily. I tend to think they also want to emulate them in the way they were able to reshape the rules of the game in terms of shaping Israeli responses and defining what is an attack and, you know, what's legitimate attack and what isn't a legitimate attack. And by the way, Hezbollah seemed to make very good use out of that because they could tell people in the south, we protected you. Who else protected you in southern Lebanon? Now it's the rules of the game. Israel cannot hit civilians. Now you could say, look, and also in Gaza, like in Hezbollah, by the way, these guys fire from civilian areas. What do you want? Basically, I assume that's part of Hamas's strategy to define the rules of the game and to spin it around very quickly and to leverage that politically and say, we are the protectors of the people of Gaza, and what does Abu Mazen do having cocktails with the Israelis? So there's that seventh point. That's the challenges on one side. And I'm sure Dennis could come up with others. And maybe you will come up with more yet. The other side of the ledger, maybe someone say, look, a ceasefire is good. Because, look, a ceasefire is important because Annapolis can't work otherwise. This isn't Oslo. You know, when I wrote a book on Oslo and decision-making, what I really noticed is when these guys are sitting in Norway away from the action, it didn't matter what was going on the ground, basically. They were insulated from what was going on the ground because the negotiations were happening far away. But in this case, it's a very tightly held set of negotiations. You have Livni and Abu Allah and Ofer Dekel, not Ofer Dekel, the Udi Dekel and on the security side. So, I mean, it's tightly held. And Olmert is involved with Abu Mazen. So these are people that are very much impacted by what's going on in the broader sense because they're the decision makers. They're not kind of the Uri Saviers and the Joel Singers and people that are far away from the action. So what happens there does impact them. And it certainly impacts their, before I get to the public, I'll just say we should be a little humble in saying that we could say with certainty nothing is going on in those negotiations. Because I think of it as a submarine, which is those talks are not going to resurface until the end. Because each side, the issues are so ultra-sensitive that no one wants to divulge what's really going on. So everyone in Washington can say, nothing's going on. But the truth is, we really don't know. And the other things the only things we do here is we've heard some good things. We've heard Abu Mazen, they'll say publicly some bad things. We don't know what's really going on. But you got to believe what's going on in Gaza does impact it, because these are the decision makers. These are not third-level people sitting in Norway. It impacts the publics. As you know, my favorite line, you know, the people didn't like to pull out of Gaza. They didn't like the book. They don't want to see the movie in the West Bank. So it impacts them. It impacts the Palestinians, because if you can only imagine violence, you're certainly not going to believe that this peacemaking is going to go anywhere, and you don't think these leaders can actually are strong enough to make a change. So there's a public dimension to it, too. Certainly, politically, the violence has an impact on the Olmert government. Olmert just went to Ashkelon. And you could say, look, it took a lot of guts. He went to the people in Ashkelon. He told them the truth. He said, look, I'm not going to tell you this is a one-off phenomenon. I'm going to tell you it's very possible this is going to keep happening. And you could say whatever Israel does, if it does a military option, if it continues the status quo, Ashkelon could be hit. But certainly for Israel, this is an urgent issue. This is not an issue they could just say, ah, Gaza, you just got to live with it. I mean, when you have thousands of rockets falling in your country, you can't just tell people live with it. So Olmert can find, you know what, for the longevity of his government, Bibi Netanyahu and the opposition is already attacking him. How can you tell the people of Ashkelon what you told them? But there's a public dimension to this and a political dimension for Olmert's government. He might find that a ceasefire is more useful. I would think for Hamas, they might find it useful if they want to have a prelude to a prisoner release where they want to let other guys out. People assume a ceasefire is part of that. So they may say for their purposes, it's a good thing to do. And you could argue from an IDF perspective, let's say the IDF thinks the following. Hezbollah is rearming in southern Lebanon. You know, better to deal with them at some point than not deal with them before they're fully armed. Maybe the IDF, given what happened in Lebanon War, is trying to retrain and everything, but maybe it can't focus on two fronts. So maybe the army there has to decide which front is more important and put all its resources in that front. So there's arguments, I think, in each direction. What is the military option? And here I do think it's important to refine it a bit than what's out there in the public. It seems to me that the option is not a military option of taking over all of Gaza. That's a much more dramatic thing. But I would argue, my sense is, if Israel's going to do a military option, its focus is the town of Rafah on the Palestinian side. Because if you really look at the tunnels, even though people say it goes along the Philadelphia Road, because of the nature of the sand dunes and all that, the real tunnels are in the Rafah area. And remember, there's two Rafahs. There's the Palestinian side of Rafah and there's the Egyptian side of Rafah. Israel's not out to invade Egypt, so to speak. But they might say, go over, take the city of Rafah. From what we hear, the trunk of the tunnel, the main focal of the tunnel, is there. On the Egyptian side, is you got the entrance ramps. I won't call them exit ramps because the weapons seem to be going in one direction. So I'll call them entrance ramps, not exit ramps. But the entrance ramps are there. They plug up one, and then nothing happens. But the trunk is on the Palestinian side. So you could say, okay, look, this isn't going to be easy. To take over the city of Rafah means you're going to have to fight your way in. That means that Hamas is a new thing. Israeli occupation is a battle cry. The Israeli public will say, look, the international community, the United States, everyone failed us. We got out of Gaza, and we didn't get any credit for it. We're called occupiers anyway. So you know what? If we have to occupy, let's occupy. We don't need to take over all of Gaza. But we got to get to the point of the bottleneck where the weaponry comes in. Because we know the weaponry is coming in from Sudan. We know it's coming in from all over the Middle East. We know there's four-point Grud rockets coming from Iran that are being specially assembled, so they're thin enough that they could fit through a tunnel. But this is the last point in that. So the main thing is if you cut off the tunnels but really do it, you might have to retake that city. And that's where I assume if there is a military option, it's on the city and not on the whole, maybe in the Beit Hanun area in the north or something, but not the whole area of Gaza. I assume it's all about Rafah. So, but is that a great option? Because what happens there, you know, given the points I made. Now, what can the United States do in this situation? And I do think it's important to have an international consensus and to have more U.S. statements about the whole idea of firing from civilian areas and what that means for retaliation. I do think that's important for American officials to say that. Is it enough? No. You need the Arabs. I keep believing only Arabs can delegitimize Hamas. I felt this way for a long time. And here the Arab states, which are very loath to make the moral argument, I'm not here, don't misinterpret me, I'm not here to cede the moral argument. Let's say as a point of emphasis that it's certainly counterproductive that there's not going to be an Annapolis if this continues. That's an argument I think Arab states can make pretty convincingly as Arab states. And I think they would carry some weight. So I think that's something to think about, the delegitimation. And then the final point I would just make is the focus on Egyptian-Israeli relations. I really think for the United States, whether you go for a ceasefire, whether you go for not a ceasefire, it certainly might be harder if there's a military option, but or you continue with the status quo, or you go the ceasefire route, yeah, the U.S. really has to make this a point of emphasis. I know Amos Gilad travels there, and I know Suleiman comes back and forth, but I don't know if that's enough. The militaries need to talk to each other, not just the intelligence people need to talk to each other. And that seems to me missing. We're hearing rumors that Defense Minister Tantawi of Egypt is about to make his first visit to the United States in a very long time. So I don't know if that's official or not, but those are the rumors we're hearing. That might be an opportunity to really press this point of stronger Egyptian-Israeli relations. It seems to me that Egypt knows how to focus when its national security is at stake. It's gotten very little media attention here. I know people gripe about Egypt, saying, well, their idea of Bukra, I mean, tomorrow is mañana without the urgency. But the point here is, when Egypt's national security is at stake, starting up, my understanding, from February 15th, the last few weeks, they are really massively building a barrier on their side to make sure that Hamas doesn't repeat what they're doing. I won't get into things. Is it a wall? Is it a fence? It's a triple-layer barrier. And they've done it on the city of Rafah within record time. It's gotten no media attention, but I think it's really fascinating that they have galvanized in the last 3 weeks when their national security interests are at stake. And they could say that's little comfort for Israel and the ceasefire concept, because that's to stop Hamas from coming into the Sinai. It doesn't have anything to do with tunnels going into to Gaza. But it seems to me that these issues are related. When things heat up, it won't be good for Egypt. Egypt does have some cards. They apparently have 300 Hamas prisoners that they're holding. They're holding in the Sinai. These are people that have been, you know, when they opened up, that the Egyptians have nabbed. That's what we've been hearing. So I don't know. Some say you just have to buy off the Bedouins in Rafah who are doing all this business. Maybe move some of the commerce over ground to dry up some of the tunnels that are commercial value, I don't know. But it seems to me the Egyptian-Israeli component is crucial, no matter how you slice and dice this problem. Final point, apart from Gaza, it seems to me if Annapolis is going to have hope, I don't want to belabor it, my old song, but I do think the people have to see things on the ground, because they won't see anything out of the negotiations, because assuming they're going fabulously, it's going to be a submarine, no one's going to know about it, so there's no public bump up. Gaza's right now been a total negative story. The only thing left is what's happening on the West Bank. And there they have to see, that there's something moving on the ground. I feel it's making these crossing points more efficient. My understanding now is that 40% of crossing points are being privatized with privatized security companies. The lines are getting shorter. Why not take that much further? Israel's got concerns about PATV, the glorification of suicide bombers. Let people see some real change. And I think, you know, the issue of settlements is clearly going to be a part of this. So there's a lot here to be done. Let me just end on a sports analogy. Everyone knows I like sports. I won't mention baseball this time. I will say it's been pointed out to me that I'm not a big soccer fan. But in the game of soccer, this was one point I wanted to make on the Egyptian-Israeli context. When you want to intercept the other side, you don't wait till all the pressure's on the goalie. You don't let them come all the way downfield and always be in a defensive spot in the goalie. You've got to intercept much farther downfield. And if there's all this stuff coming in from Sudan and all sorts of maritime things where things are coming off boats, it seems to me the interception has to go offshore and way not just at the crossing point at Philadelphia, then at Rafah, then it's too late. So there needs to be a multi-layered strategy. I think the United States is crucial in trying to get Egypt and Israel to work together. I think we have to think through all these different options of ceasefire, not ceasefire, military option. I'm sorry I didn't come down forthrightly on any option, but I hope to extend a tiny bit, we start thinking about the assumptions and the challenges to each option. Maybe it'll help us develop our thinking. Thank you very much.